over here.
We have a full hour's tape on that, so we can waste it. Other than if we need to. Well, I guess the first question I'd like to ask, since this is for the Paris Review, as you know, in this series has been a series of writers on writers at work who have described chiefly their work habits and how the way the creative process works for them. We might ask you at first if there is anything particular about the way you have written and do write your novels that you think would be of interest, that is unique.
Well, I work regularly. I always work in the mornings and generally work again a little bit before dinner. I'm not one of those who works at night. I prefer to read at night or do something else, but I very seldom write at night. Then, in general, I write everything many times over. I mean, all my thoughts are second thoughts, and I correct each page a great deal or rewrite it several times as I go along.
Can we assume from Philip Coral's notebooks that you have used yourself, notebooks as starting places for some of your novels?
Well, I don't keep notebooks. I have occasionally kept diaries for short periods, but I'm very lazy. I mostly don't. One should keep notebooks, I think, but I haven't.
May I stop things for a moment and see, just to make sure we're recording all right here and try this out?
The rise and fall of Maya civilization.
Record now. This wipes off the old one, and whatever we say now will go on. Have you found in regards to the actual writing process that novels have changed under your hands, as it's been the case for some novelists? That
oh yes,
in your revision things have come out differently than you intended.
Well, I know very dimly when I start what's going to happen. I just have a very general idea. And then the thing develops as I write. And sometimes, I mean, it's happened to me more than once that I will write a great deal and find it just doesn't work and have to throw the whole thing away.
Have there been occasions where that has happened to you in the last 15 or 20 years when you've turned out fewer novels per annum, as it were, than you did in the 20s?
Well, I have, as you say, written very few novels in the last years, and I haven't... It took me a long time to write this last short one, The Genius and the Goddess, but I didn't have to throw anything enormous away there.
You said while you were writing Ape and Essence, I believe, when you were interviewed, that it seemed to be extraordinarily difficult to write fiction in that period, right after the war and after the atomic bomb. Do you feel that same difficulty now in the composition of fiction?
Well, I'm writing at the moment a rather peculiar kind of fiction. I'm not writing a fiction about the immediate surroundings. I'm writing a kind of fantasy at the moment, a kind of reversed Brave New World about a society in which real efforts are made to realize human potentialities. And this doesn't refer to the actual world around, but it's an extremely difficult project, this, but it's a very interesting one.
the direct reflection of a kind of post-war society that you had in Ape and Essence was the reason then for the difficulty.
Well, Ape and Essence was just, after all, a pure fantasy, a pure parable, a fable. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with the world as it existed then or now.
One of the things that the Paris Review editor asked us to ask you was something about relationships that you might care to comment upon between the use of such drugs as lysergic acid and mescaline and a creative imagination. I don't know quite how to ask this, but maybe one way would be, do you think that creative process can be helped or creative talents help quantitatively or qualitatively by the use of my synthetic acid.
I don't think there's any generalization one can make on this, because the experience and observation and reading case histories have shown that there's an enormous variation in the way people respond to it. Some people, I think, probably could get direct aesthetic inspiration for either for painting or for poetry out of it. Others, I don't think, could. I think it makes, for most people, it's an extremely significant experience, and I suppose in an indirect way would help the creative process. But I don't think one can sit down and say, I want to write a magnificent poem, and I'm therefore going to take lysergic acid. I don't think by any means certain that you would get the result you wanted. You might have almost any result, but whether you would get a direct assistance in doing what you'd set out to do, I don't know.
Do you think it might be more helpful for somebody like a lyric poet than for a novelist? The problem might be...
Well, he would certainly get an extraordinary view of life, which he would, which he wouldn't have had in any other way, and this might help him a great deal. Of course, the most significant thing about the experience, as far as most people is concerned, is that during the experience, you're really not interested in doing anything practical, even writing lyric poetry, and you're not particularly interested in words, because the experience transcends words and is quite inexpressible in terms of words. And the whole notion of conceptualizing what is happening seems very silly. But after the event, it seems to me quite possible that it might be of great assistance, that people would see the universe around them in a very different way, would be inspired possibly to write something about it.
Do you think there's a variation, or that I gather you do think there is a variation then among people as to how lengthy the effect is, and how much carryover there is from the experience?
Well, there's always a complete memory of the experience. I mean, you remember something extraordinary having happened. And to some extent, there is in many cases, I think, a certain reliving of the experience, particularly of the transformation of the outside world. You get hints of this after the experience is over. You see the world in this transfigured way every now and then, not to the same pitch of intensity, but to something of the kind. I mean, it does, I think, help you to look at the world in a new way. And you understand, too, very clearly the way that certain specially gifted people have seen the world. I mean, it becomes quite clear the sort of world that Van Gogh lived in, or the sort of world that Blake lived in. You begin to have a direct experience of this kind of world while you're under the drug, and after the drug is over, you can remember and to some slight extent recapture this kind of world which certain privileged people have lived in, moved in and out of, as Blake did, obviously, all the time.
But the artist's talents after the experience are not going to be roughly the same as they were before he took the drug, so that they're really...
Well, I don't see why they should be different. I mean, the experiments have been made to see what painters can do under the influence of the drug, and most of the examples I've seen are very uninteresting. I mean, actually, you could never hope to reproduce to the full extent the quite incredible intensity of colouring which you get under the influence of the drug. And most of the things I've seen are just rather tiresome bits of expressionism, mm-hmm. which correspond hardly at all, I would think, to what was the actual experience. Maybe an immensely gifted artist might. I mean, somebody like Odilon Redon, probably who saw the world like this all the time anyhow, but perhaps this would have intensified his experience of the world and have made it easier for him to to have some of these visionary models from which he painted, these models from the inward eye and from the visions with his eyes shut, and then this vision of the external world transfigured, which you, were the two aspects of the experience.
Lecture and this whole question, but it is really getting us off the point. Mm-hmm. Well, I was interested in this last part, I think, as relates to fiction, if there is an increase in one's powers of psychological observation and insight, this is, affects fiction.
Yes, but I don't think, after all, fiction is a sustained thing, isn't it? I mean, this is a sort of temporary revelation of a moment, which is something very different from what it has to be in fiction. I mean, you have to have a whole series of inspirations and a whole series of hard work on the basis of inspiration to carry through a long piece of fiction.
Nevertheless, if it gave you a deeper comprehension, that would... what we non-writers, of course, think immediately is that if we could get our hands on the drug, we would suddenly be liberated and creative and made over into different men, in fact.
Well, one is. It can be a very liberating and widening experience. I mean, if only because it shows one that the world one habitually lives in is a creation of this rather conventional, closely conditioned being that one is, and that there are quite other kinds of worlds outside, and that that other people undoubtedly have always seen the world in this way, in a more controlled way, of course, than you can have under the drug. But I think it is a very salutary experience to realize that the rather dull universe in which most of us spend most of our time is not necessarily the only universe there is. I think it's healthy that people should have this experience.
Well, to move to another topic now, you have Philip Coles say once, that I'm not a congenital novelist. Would you say that that's true of yourself?
Well, I don't think I am a very congenital novelist, no. I have great difficulty in inventing plots, and I don't have things pouring out in front of me all the time. Some people, of course, have this amazing gift of storytelling, which I've never had at all. I mean, when one reads, for example, Stevenson's account of how all the plots of his stories were provided in dreams by his subconscious mind, he called the brownies working for him, and that all he had to do was to work it up when they had provided the material. This I've never had, and this has always been a great difficulty for me of creating situations and putting all sorts of different kinds of people into them.
Creating people and having them talk came more easily to you than the plot or story of the novel.
Well, yes, but even then, I'm not very good at creating people. I mean, I don't have a very wide repertory of people. These are difficult things for me. I mean, I think it's largely a question of temperament. I don't happen to have the right kind of temperament.
I would have thought perhaps what you meant by that phrase was that you had other interests. Congenital novelists were sort of...
Another way of saying the same thing, that I suppose the congenital novelist doesn't have other interests. I mean, this is an absorbing thing which fills up his mind and takes all his time and energies, whereas someone else with a different kind of mind has these other extracurricular activities going on.
Is there any difference in your novels as to the degree to which you were totally involved in them when you wrote them? Perhaps that's one question, or another one might be, which are you most happy with when you think back on it now?
Well, I don't know. I personally think the most successful was Time Must Have a Stop. But I don't know. It seemed to me that I integrated the sort of what may be called the essay element with the fictional element better than in other novels, but maybe this is not the case. It just happens to be the one that that I like the best and feel that was came off best.
Do you feel that your last novel, The Genius of the Goddess, was more was different in kind, as some critics thought, from almost all the other that you had done?
Well, the method was something which I had used before, and some of these long short stories or novelettes which I'd written in the past, like Two or Three Graces, it was not unlike in method to that.
It seems to me, the reason I bring this up is that some reviewers I read seem to not know what to make quite of The Genius of the Goddess, expecting something that they didn't find, perhaps more satirical material in it, or perhaps they thought they expected to not to find such a happy view of sex in this novel as they did find. Do you feel a change in those ways, that there's less satire, less?
Well, it was a straight story. The point of the story, it seemed to me what gave it a certain value was the fact that you had this extra dimension given by the fact that it was told by the man in old age looking back on his past. So you've got a certain enrichment, I think, of the character of the young man by it being told, by the story being told by the same man when he was old. That for me was the interesting part of the story.
Which of the congenital novelists of our century have you read with the most pleasure? Which do you admire the most? English or continental?
Well, let me see. It's awfully difficult for me to answer these questions because, the individual books I like and take things from and am stimulated by. It's difficult for me to say which author as a whole has been.
Just tell me a few of the ones that you did find stimulated. I don't care about specific answers to that question.
Well, of course, Lawrence I read a great deal in the 20s. As a very young man, as an undergraduate, I used to read a lot of French novels and was very fond of a novelist who is now very much out of date, that is Anatole France. I haven't read him for 40 years now. I don't know what he's like. Then I remember reading the first volume of Proust in 1915 and being tremendously impressed by it. And then Gide I read at that time.
Were you much pleased with Joyce?
Never very much, no. I never got very much out of Ulysses. I mean, I think it's an extraordinary book, but I leave it at that.
Have you read much Faulkner?
Yes, I used to read the early novels with great admiration and pleasure, the Soldier's Pay and Light in August, and what were the other early ones? Sound and the Fury. Yes.
You would call Faulkner one of the congenital
storytellers? Oh, well, my goodness, yes. He obviously has an enormous gift, hasn't he?
Well, 30 years later now, what do you think, or would you care to say what you think of Lawrence as a novelist and as a man? He's back in the public eye.
Well, I occasionally reread some of them. I must say, I think he's extraordinarily good. I mean, the short stories are amazingly good. I read a part of the Women in Love the other day. I didn't read the whole of it. That again seemed to me very good. And, I was very fond of Lawrence. He was a man I knew him very well in the last 4 years of his life. I just met him during the First World War and saw him a certain amount then. But I didn't get to know him till 1926 really well. And then I became very fond of him.
Had you disliked him before you got to know him well? I think I read.
Well, I was a little sort of disturbed by him, and he was rather disturbing and difficult to understand to a sort of conventionally brought up young bourgeois. He was difficult. But later on, I got to know him. My first wife became very friendly with him and understood him, and they got on very well together. We were there when he died in 1930. He actually died in my first wife's arms at Vence.
You explained to us that you don't read much fiction anymore, and that you don't practice it totally. Of course, it's obvious that you won't. You've done so much of writing in other realms. Have your attitudes towards art and towards fiction changed over the years? Do you think less highly of fiction?
Oh, no. I think. No. I think fiction. Fiction and biography and history are the forms. I mean, I think one can say much more about general abstract ideas in terms of concrete characters and situations, whether fictional or real, than one can in abstract terms. I mean, several of the books I like best, what I've written, are historical and biographical things. I mean, Grey Eminence and the Devils of Loudun and the study of Maine de Biron, the Variations on a Philosopher. I mean, these, in a sense, are all discussions of important general ideas in terms of specific lives and incidents. And I must say, I think that probably all philosophy ought to be written in this form, and it would be much more profound and much more edifying. I mean, it's awfully easy to write abstractly and not to attach much meaning to it. But the moment you have to express these ideas in the context of a particular life and a particular set of circumstances, although it's a limitation in some ways, it's also an invitation to go much further and much deeper. I think that fiction and, as I say, history and biography are immensely important, not only for their own sake, because they provide a sort of picture of life now and life in the past, but also as vehicles for the expression of general philosophic ideas, religious ideas, social ideas.
Well, I find that very interesting. I've never heard such a good defense of the greater profundity of art.
Well, I mean, my goodness, I mean, Dostoevsky is six times as profound as Kierkegaard, because he writes fiction. I mean, here you have this abstract man going on and on like Coleridge. It's nothing compared with the really profound fictional man who just has to always to keep these tremendous ideas alive in a concrete form. I mean, it's the reconciliation of the, it's the expression of the absolute in the relative, so to speak, of the general in the particular. And this is, seems to me, the exciting thing, both in life and in art.
concentrated question. Moving from that point, or comparing that point that you were making now to the earlier one about the natural storyteller, the natural the man for whom it's easy to conceive.
Well, I mean, there are lots of excellent storytellers who are simply storytellers, and I think it's a wonderful gift, after all. I mean, I suppose the supreme example is Dumas. I mean, this extraordinary old gentleman who sat down and thought nothing of writing 6 volumes of The Count of Monte Cristo in a few months. Mm-hmm. My God, Monte Cristo is damned good. I mean, it's an extraordinary book. But, I mean, it isn't the last word. But, I mean, where you can get this storytelling which carries at the same time a kind of parable-like meaning as you get in, say, in Dostoevsky or in the best of Tolstoy, this is something extraordinary, I feel.
I take it from that last remark that you rate Dostoevsky ahead of Tolstoy.
No, well, I mean, they're very different, but I love them both. I mean, I think I'm always flabbergasted when I reread some of the short things of Tolstoy. I mean, like The Death of Ivan Ilyich, what an astounding work that is. And of course, some of the things, I mean, apart from the long novel, some of the short things of Dostoevsky, like the Letters from the Underworld or Notes from Underground, or whatever that's called, it is an extraordinary book.
Please don't get the impression, by the way, that we're trying to pin you down to a hierarchy. Mm. This comment of yours.
Incidentally, how awfully good short things can be. I was reading the other day, I hadn't read for some time. My goodness, it's good. The Adolphe of Benjamin Constant. Extraordinary book.
I think there's a great vogue now of the short novel, and it's about to be declared pontifically a form. Mm. And we'll have all sorts of learned treatises on the short novel. Oh, they've been written all along.
Yes.
But there's a great preoccupation, it seems to me, with this as a distinct type, perhaps, or what is a novel, or what is a blue line, and how many words, this kind of thing.
You have, in The Genius and the Goddess, and in some of those long stories, like if you found it, well...
I think of 2 or 3 Graces as a novel, really.
Yes, it's a novelette. I mean, what is it, probably 25,000 words. I mean, when is a novel not a novel? One always feels so delighted to get away with it. I mean, publishers ask for 80,000 words and you can get away with 30. That's really is a great coup, I feel.
But this kind of profounder novel that you've been describing, I can see would be illustrated by Lawrence at his best when he's in his short novels.
Yes, and I mean, again, some of the long short stories of Lawrence are quite extraordinary, I think. The vividness, and of course the incredible vividness of the descriptions of nature, these are astounding in Lawrence.
You think of Henry James. Were you ever fond of him?
I was never very fond of James. He leaves me very cold on the whole. I read The Spoils of Poynton not long ago, which I hadn't read for a very long time. Found it very disappointing.
How about Thomas Mann?
I find him a little boring, but I think he's obviously a very admirable novelist. Puddenbrooks is an excellent book.
Thing too, the shorter fiction there.
Yes, some of those are good. Although even there, I used to go every summer to the place which is described in Mario and the Magician. Uh-huh. And it seemed to me that, I don't know, I never got any sense of the place out of that, which, I mean, I knew it very well. It was this coast where Shelley was washed up, just north of Viareggio.
I have a vivid image of the inside of that hall, but I don't remember.
No, I think it's more or less on Isn't Mario and the Magician? Yes, I think it's the
one. Porto Venere, I've never been there. I've had...
Well, you see, Porto Venere is at Spezia, and this is, as far as I remember, is a beach south of that, which is Marina di Massa, Carrara, Forte dei Marmi, and so on. Forte dei Marmi, I have always presumed it was, because there were a great many Germans who lived there, and I imagine Mann must often have come there.
No, I thought it was on the Adriatic.
No, this is the under the mountains of Massa and Carrara, where the marble comes from, which is an incredibly beautiful place. Now, needless to say, it's all become like Coney Island. So there's millions of people there.
Yeah, we're running out of questions, George. You've got some that I haven't touched on.
I think there's a question of general interest about what might be called the evolution of your novels, the tendency from satire at the beginning or greater generalization about other matters and merely social behavior. And I was wondering if, in transplanting yourself from England to America, you hadn't altered the basis for your fiction. Critics like to talk a great deal about the alienation of the modern artist world at large. Here's a very clear case of a man who has moved from his society and his audience to another world. Does this have any appreciable effect on your life?
I don't know. I don't think it has. I mean, I've never very strongly felt that the place where I lived had a great importance to me. I mean, I actually, since I was an adult, have lived a great deal, mainly out of England. I lived in Italy, I lived in France, traveled a good deal.
In other words, you don't think that fiction generally fosters a particular social climate.
Well, fiction, I mean, what is fiction? I mean, this is a genus of which there are many species, surely. I mean, I think it's perfectly true in certain species of fiction quite clearly call for a certain... I mean, after all, it's impossible to imagine that Trollope could have written except where he did write. I mean, Trollope couldn't have gone like Byron and Shelley to live in Italy, obviously. He required this English middle-class life to write about. But on the other hand, it seems, I mean, Browning, who was in a sense a novelist, could write perfectly well, or D'Azzolo, or Florence, or anybody like. I mean, this is the trouble. I think so many people talk about the writer or fiction as though the writer were the writers were the writer. I mean, they always are very diverse members of a very considerable group. And the same way it seems to me with fiction, that you get obviously excellent fiction, which is has to be related to a particular place. I mean, look at Lawrence's fiction. I mean, at the beginning, you would have said that this fiction had to be related to the Midlands of England and the coal mine. But, I mean, Lawrence demonstrated that it could be related to anything. I mean, he moved about the world.
Yes, he carried his world with him, but he also changed its setting. He wrote about Mexico, and he wrote about Italy, he stopped writing about Midlands coal miners, too.
Yes, but, I mean, say, he wasn't a regional writer bound to a place. I mean, he at the beginning he might have been supposed to be, but I mean, he could in fact move about and write about anything.
Nevertheless, it's true in your work that your subject matter, if you can call it that, has changed. Of course, this may be due to another reason. Perhaps your interests have changed. You're no longer interested in what you're interested in the 20s. You've given up social satire of that sort completely.
Yes, I think that's true.
Um,
Well, I suppose I have a change in that sense, but I think wherever I've been, I would have probably changed in any case.
Do you think of those novels, or the earliest novels, as satiric, basically? I've somehow said that you don't, and that you don't like this word.
No, I'm all for satire. I think there should be a lot more satire than there is in the world. I think we need it very strongly, that people take things much too seriously now.
I think we need it over here even more than the English do.
Yes, I think everybody needs it. I mean, there is a tendency to be solemn about things. I mean, I'm all for people sticking pins into Episcopal behinds and things like that. I mean, it seems to be a very good proceeding.
Will you find that in your early reading of satirical writers, I think part of your satirical cast in your early books was related to Victor Farnham, the Swift?
I was very fond of Swift, and the book I was very fond of, one of the few old funny books which remains funny, which is The Letters of Obscure Men, the Epistolae Obscurorum Virorum, which is incredibly funny. Even now, I think Swift must have read them, because they're so much his method. This is a wonderful book.
Have you read much of Evelyn Waugh, who it seems to me has followed along very much in your footsteps?
I haven't read his last two or three books. I enjoyed the early ones very much.
The last few books are not so funny. In fact, he's got another solemn, though there are passages which are hilariously funny.
The last one I know is Bryce had revisited. That's quite
long. Oh, no. There was The Ordeal of Gilbert Pinfold, which is a rather interesting account of a hallucinatory, not single experience, but series of experiences that he had. And then I guess the trilogy, Officers and Gentlemen.
Yes, I haven't read that. Is that good?
No, I don't think that's up to his earlier stuff. I think Bryce Had Revisited is actually his best single work, but the earlier ones, funniest of all. You know Aubrey Mennon, who is again, it seems to me, in this.
I read, let me think, the first of his books, which was that. I haven't read the. He wrote on a subject.
Of Witches?
Yes, I read that one. That is, he wrote on a subject which I wrote on an essay many years ago.
The Abode of Love.
The Abode of Love. I made a long study of that interesting gentleman, and it came out in a volume about 25 years ago. I was interested to see that he'd found this fantastic story. But I would like to read it, see what he's made of it, because I happen to know a good deal about the original documents.
Yeah. I did read it. It didn't strike me so much as some of his other work. Mm. He's a very interesting person. I've met him.
I never met him.
And he's lived in Amalfi, and he's now moved to Rome in both a physical and spiritual sense. After part Hindu, part Irish, and a complete internationalist, and now he's settled in Rome. He's very lively in his paintings.
But you say in a spiritual sense, has he joined the church?
Yes.
Well, that's
very
interesting.
After prevalence of witches, particularly, and he brought a biography, Dead Man, the Silver Market.
You say that you were fond of Swift and you used to read him a lot. How did you approach Pope or any other 18th century poet? We've noticed, Jordan particularly pointed out to me, that you often have quoted in your books romantic poets. You don't quote so much others. Is this showing preference for romantic poets?
Well, I mean, I'm old-fashioned enough to think that they're better poets than Pope was. I mean, I think Pope is good. I mean, in the worst inn's worst room, with cloth half hung, with floors of plaster and walls of dung. It's very fine, but it isn't as fine as some of the romantic poets. I like Pope, yes. And I get a great deal out of the 18th century in general. I mean, I think Hume's essays are really admirable, and then the religious writers of the 18th century, like Law. I mean, the Law's mystical works are absolutely extraordinary. And then the French people. I like the French novelists. I mean, people like Crébillon, and then the later ones, this enormous masterpiece of the Liaison Dangereuse. Extraordinary book, which influenced Stendhal so much. And then and Diderot, I'm very fond of. I mean, there's a wonderful man. I mean, one of the only intellectuals who's ever been interested in the practical affairs of industry. And that's almost unique.
Thinking of your citation of Fielding in the essay, The Tragedy and the Whole Truth.
Yes.
I
love Fielding. I think he's a wonderful writer.
believe the general thesis of that essay?
I still believe that tragedy is not necessarily the highest form. I mean, I think the highest form does not yet exist, but I can conceive something much more inclusive than tragedy. Equally sublime, but also, I mean, it's adumbrated in some of the things of Shakespeare, but I think that if we get another Shakespeare one of these days, which I hope we do, maybe we shall see something really terrific.
You consider the tragedies of Shakespeare impure in that sense?
I think they could go further. I mean, I think they, in some way, the tragic and the comic elements could be more totally fused. I don't know how, don't ask me how, but I mean, the Homeric thing, of course, as I say in that essay, is a kind of version of the totality, but on a very simple-minded level. But my goodness, how good Homer is, anyhow. Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you another absolutely sublime writer who has this, which is Chaucer, of course. It's one of the great misfortunes of English literature that he wrote at a time when his language is now nearly incomprehensible. If he'd written 200 or 300 years later, I think the whole of English literature would have been changed. We wouldn't have had this sort of Platonic mania of separating mind from body and spirit from matter and so on.
If he could have combated that single-handed.
Well, I mean, he was on a sufficiently great scale. I mean, he was obviously the most enormous genius. Oh, wonderful book. And really, when one reads the prologue of the Canterbury Tales or any of the maturer tales, they're really extraordinary. And they're so beautiful. But it's a shame that most people really can't read him except in a translation. Yes, but I mean, they have to take a bit of trouble, don't they? I mean, you have to.
They don't like it the first time.
They don't like it, but you.
They really come to like it.
Oh, good. I'm delighted to hear it. Yes.
In fact, usually the last meeting of the class, I bring in an audit translation.
Yes.
And mind you, these students, I have to use future scientists, literary students.
That's interesting. What do you... I went to... some years ago, I was asked to go over to Caltech and had a talk with some of the students there. And that was really pathetic. I mean, they said, well, of course, 25% of our time is supposed to be given to the humanities, but our amount that we have to do in basic physics and chemistry is so terrific, we just never had any time to read at all outside the actual classes we do. It was quite touching. I mean, they wanted to, but they just didn't have the time. I mean, do yours have time to...
Well, they're quite pressed for time, but they put more time in, actually. Mm. They have more, a larger percentage of their program is devoted to the humanities than at Caltech. And, a little early to say, we're only beginning that third year. Basically, they all seem to be very keen.
Well, that's good.
Still, I would expect they would say, too, that they don't have free time.
They do manage to do reading above and beyond the call of duty, though. Extraordinary to me, especially a sophomore.
Well, of course, in both these schools, these kids are awfully bright.
Yes. Is this one of this group here, the Pomona Claremont group?
This is the latest. Now, Ray is at Pomona College.
Yes.
The oldest, and Harvey Mudd has just come along.
Now, what exactly is Harvey Mudd? Is this, you say, a mainly scientific college?
Yes, it's just a smaller version of Caltech.
Oh, I see.
And it's placing more emphasis, even in Caltech, on basic science and on humanities.
And has it got a graduate school, or is it only an undergraduate school?
Well, the four undergraduate colleges also are associated with the graduate school.
I see.
People in the undergraduate colleges teach courses in graduate school.
I see, yes.
But we don't have any real program in graduate science.
Mm. No, not as yet. There's only botany and biology in graduate school so far. I was wondering if you had any connection with the Claremont College and sent some of your books. They're not in the library.
Well, I had a number of sort of superfluous books, and they came and bought them from me. I thought a very generous rate, which I was able to take off my income tax. Well, I presented, that's what it was. I presented it to them and then took it off my income tax. They told me this was a wonderful device. And as I had a lot of books, I didn't know what more to do with. I was delighted to.
Mr. Davies will always be willing to give you a good rate on income tax.
Well, maybe I'll look up some more books and send him a postcard to come and look at them.
Well, they think a lot of ingenious ways to make profit on it.
I remember you might see me out about twice as much as I originally paid for the book. Well, I think we could. Well, I think our last question is, what sort of writing are you doing now? You've already
said
this informally, but I don't think we have it on the tape, do we? And are you writing any poetry, and are you writing memoirs or anything like
that? Well, I'm fortunately not writing any poetry, because I find it just takes too much time. I mean, it's an entirely whole-time job, and then I'm not happy with the results. It just isn't good enough. But I'm in the intervals of doing these lectures at UCSB, which take quite a lot of time. I am working on this long fantasy and hoping to get it done within 6 months or a year. I don't know how long it will take.
That's your main project.
Yes. Apart from these lectures, this is all I'm doing.
You got a tentative title for that?
I have no title at all. I have no idea what it'll be called.
One more particular question, which you may not if you want to answer. I was wondering if you were in any way connected in the early 20s or earlier with the so-called Bloomsbury.
Well, I knew them all very well. I was never actually a Bloomsbury, but I knew them very well. I mean, the sort of ruling Bloomsburys then were Lytton Strachey and Roger Frine, Vanessa Bell and Virginia Woolf. Roger I got a great deal out of. I mean, he was a real liberal education as far as art was concerned. I mean, his enormous knowledge and sensibility, and he was a wonderful talker. And then Clive Bell, of course, was around, and Kane. I was looking at some the other day. They are very strange. They're very beautiful, aren't they? But one gets a peculiar feeling from them that she sees with incredible clarity that always there's this sheet of plate glass between her and the object seen. She never touches anything somehow. I think To the Lighthouse probably is the most immediate of them. The other ones are... I don't know. They're very puzzling to me. The Lighthouse. It's a beautiful book, isn't it? Yes, that's very good too. That's very good.
To me, it's much better than Ulysses.
Well, so much of Joyce's book consists of rather lengthy demonstrations of how a novel ought not to be written, doesn't it? I mean, he does show about every conceivable way in which it should not be written, and then he goes on to show how it might be written.
Did you read with pleasure Forster's novels?
Yes, I'm very fond of those, and I'm very fond of his essays, too. What admirable essays there are in Abinger Harvest. It's a pity he stopped writing, isn't it? He was writing novels, isn't it?
Yes, you wonder why. Yeah.
I saw him last year in London. He's very surprised. He's 80 now.
Yeah. He's been a rash. He's been doing the articles on him.
Yeah. Well, he has a work in progress, doesn't he?
That's a work shell.
Well, I think it was because it had a homosexual subject, didn't it? I mean, this was the trouble.
There was a piece of it printed in the New York Times.
Was there?
About 10 years ago. Mm. Just a few
pages. Couldn't tell anything. Sort of like Catherine Ann Porter. Mm. It had this work going for a long time. Yes.
Forster hasn't even written any stories.
No.
Passage to Indian. I like his stories.
Yes, some were very good, weren't they? Now, what do you feel about these young English writers like Amis?
Amis? I was going to ask and, if you read. I've only read the first one.
The first one is better than the second. I read the second as well as the first. I mean, it seemed to me that everything was there in the first one, and the second was repeating what he'd said before.
Yeah, but how Charlie made out an academic situation is universal theory. Mm. All of these things are so powerful.
Universal, but not great enough to make a good novel.
No, I don't suppose that.
Well, Mary McCarthy did a good job, on the Girls of Academe.
Yeah.
And there was a very odd novel by a man whose name I now forget, about Berkeley, called Swanson. Did you ever read that?
No. Came out about of it. We both went to Berkeley. Yeah.
Well, it came out about 8 or 10 years ago, and I cannot remember who it was by. It's by an Englishman who arrives and teaches English there. And by some unfortunate accident, he's accused by his landlady of indecent exposure and put into jail for a month. And after that, his whole career is ruined, and he sort of descends and descends, and it ends up by he's obviously going to jail for about 10 years on a false charge of robbery. But it's rather an interesting book.
It's called Swanson.
Swanson, yes. And so I don't have it any longer. I must have lent it to somebody and it's never come back. But it probably would interest you as a...
Certainly, we were there at the time. Mm. I don't see how to escape it. I knew about Trio, and what was the other one? Well, I guess George Stewart's book was about the Trio. Yeah.
Dr. Norrell. That's a professional interest in
But I don't know, Amis doesn't seem to me to be going to go anywhere very much, does he seem to you, I don't think.
No, I don't think he'll come to much. Mm. Nor Angus Wilson either, though he's very amusing, I don't think he's
He can be very amusing.
Right. He's even more amusing in person. I knew him rather well when he was there.
Yeah.
You know, when I was working with this museum, he was there as curator. He was a marvelous mimic. Mm. He asked the telephone, you know, and I called. And then go on talking, carrying on this conversation, mimicking the person who calls, until someone else calls. Go on like that all day long. It's terribly funny.
Well, I think he had a broader count, too, than any of us probably.
Oh, much broader, yes.
I met Amis at Princeton last year. He was giving a series of lectures on science fiction, of all things. And I can go for such a very many lectures on this, I don't know. But he had a series of lectures on that. Who's the other young writer?
Brain, the room at the top.
That's not a good
reading. No, it seems it's not bad, but it's not very good. And it's better than the movie they made of it.
But it's kind of a movie sort of book.
Yes.
Well, there's Wayne, is the other one commonly mentioned. I don't know.
Well, there's Wayne and then the other Wilson, the Colin Wilson, yes.
Well, I don't think
And then there's a young woman, what is her name?
Oh, Iris Murdoch. She's
yes,
very good.
I haven't read her.
I think she's better than the whole lot.
Mm.
Written her fourth.
I must read some of her.
I think she's much more likely than any other young writer in England now to come to it.
Do we have her books in our library?
No, we have them all, including the. She's written a little book on Sartre.
Are there young American writers whom you've been interested in?
Well, I tried the first of Kerouac's books, but I never got very far with it. I suppose one should read some of the others now.
Well, I think they're all...
I don't feel the need myself.
Mm. I don't think they're very good. I was thinking of somebody like Malamud, a book called The Assistant and some short stories.
No, I haven't read that. Is that good?
I think he's very good. He's very limited. He writes about Jewish life in New York City, and it's and that's about it, I guess. All the stories are somewhat like this novel. But
I wish Salinger would write another novel, because that was an extraordinary book.
Well, isn't this series of stories a sort of novel that's been going on? Have you read those?
You mean the stories
in New York
at the rate of one a year?
Mm-hmm. Only a couple of years. So. Very long. I think less good than The Catcher in the Rye. It's a fascinating challenge. It's a fascinating problem to figure out what the real, how much autobiographical basis there is for these more recent stories. It's very fascinating. When that's going to be revealed.
Do you still see Gerald Hurd or Christopher?
Yes, I see them. I haven't seen Christopher for some time. He's been in England. He's teaching now at the City College, I think. Here.
Oh.
He's giving a series of lectures, I think, on contemporary novelists. But I haven't talked to him since he started on this.
Why did I shut off our machine?
Yes, I think we...
I guess I better just let this run out.
Now, would you like to see the text of this add or subtract or alter?
Well, I'm sure it'll be all right. I mean, if you'd like to send it me, I'm delighted, but I don't have to. This is for the Paris Review, is it?
Yes.
Yes.
They'd like to do it fairly soon, but we thought there would be plenty of time to send a script of what we had picked out of this and let you add or, or take away as you please with that. So we can try and do that within 10 days or so.
I'm supposed to ask you too, Mr. Huxley, if you'd be at all interested in coming out to Claremont to speak to either our Harvey Mudd undergraduates or to some of the students in the graduate school.
Well, at the moment, it's...